Good evening, folks, and welcome back again on this Saturday, the 19th day of October, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's talk about what's going on around the nation and around the world, and recap some of the events of a week that make the term insane seem like a gross understatement. And what's more, sometimes, even in a kind of a twisted way, it's helpful to remind ourselves that the nutcase ninnies of the world actually do extend even past the deep state swamp that is the Potomac. So let's start with a group that fancies itself the world's biggest brother. Despite U.S. ally Costa Rica, says the piece from Zero Hedge summarizing this insanity, mounting a last-minute effort to block the possibility, Venezuela has won a seat on the UN Human Rights Council. A shock, it says, that will outrage many anti-Maduro governments and people with half a brain throughout the West, even in the District of Criminal Swamp. The WAPO reports the news that the Maduro government will now hold a key human rights-related position at the United Nations in what Caracas says is an important achievement. And they called it an historic victory since we faced, quote, a ferocious campaign. The irony, of course, is that a government not recognized by the U.S. and its allies is further accused of a whole list of expansive human rights abuses, but now holds a U.N. decision-making post over the so-called human rights of other serfs elsewhere in the world, and it will serve a customary 3-year term. Now, here's the punchline from this one, folks, as if it's not obvious by now. Supporters of Costa Rica, which attempted to win the seat in order to prevent Venezuela from taking it, decried that the United Nations' credibility was again at stake. I mean, come on, what credibility? This is a lot like Pocahontas Elizabeth Warren's credibility when it comes to her Native American bloodline. Or the NRA worried about their credibility if they gave a seat on their board to, say, Beto O'Rourke. And furthermore, it's not like the United Nations Human Rights Council hasn't already given a seat to other bastions of human liberty, like Saudi Arabia, as well as other nations with deeply questionable human rights records, including the Philippines and Cuba. And to make matters worse when it comes to United Nations credibility, as if that was even remotely possible, Libya and Sudan also won seats Thursday alongside Venezuela. And I actually had intended to start off this evening with this story. Insanity, yes, but we've seen it coming for a long time, and it actually marks an interesting parallel, too. At the very least, it's food for thought. Not only does it involve another bastion of human rights, but it shows so clearly where we're headed, if we're not already there. Especially given all the impeachment hypocrisy about a so-called quid pro quo. Here's the headline from Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge. China secretly ordered the NBA commissioner to fire the general manager of the Houston Rockets over his tweet about Hong Kong. NBA commissioner Adam Silver revealed on Thursday that the Chinese government insisted that the league fire the general manager of the Houston Rockets, Daryl Morey, over a now-deleted, well, they did cave that far for sure, October the 4th tweet, supporting the protesters in Hong Kong. This according to Time magazine. Quote, "We made it clear that we're being asked to fire him by the Chinese government, by the parties we dealt with, government and business. You know, the infamous fascist public-private partnership." Silver didn't say that, your host did. But he did talk about the ongoing free speech scandal, adding, "We said there's no chance that's happening. There's no chance we'll even discipline him," unquote, which some of us actually have some doubt about. But speaking at the Time 100 Hell Summit, Silver noted that the losses have already been substantial. See, they've taken a hit. "Our games are not back on the air in China as we speak, and we'll see what happens next. I don't know where we go from here," Silver said, adding, "The financial consequences have been and may continue to be fairly dramatic. Yes, China is really putting the squeeze to the NBA. Now, why is this so interesting and revealing? Because what communist China, and actually what we're seeing here is more fascist than communist, it's that public-private partnership, and in this case, one of their partners isn't quite yet willing to play along, but wait, see, China is invoking the quid pro quo. You play ball, ha-ha, with us, or else. And where's the leftist media outrage on that score? Why aren't they calling for the impeachment of Xi Jinping? Come to think of it, though, maybe if they did, he could come and run for president as a Democrat. He'd be to the right of most of the people on that stage the other night. And therein lies the rub, folks. I'm so sick of hearing about President Trump's call to Ukraine. And even if the very worst that's been suggested is absolutely true, he told the Ukrainian president, you know, we have a treaty with you guys. You're supposed to pony up information about criminality being accomplished by former administration officials here. Do it, or no more gravy train aid for you. Even if that was true, it's about time somebody did precisely that. When trying to investigate real crime becomes an impeachable crime, America has a real problem. Not that we haven't known that for a long time, or that the deep state hasn't been rubbing our noses in it for quite a while. And what's changed isn't even that they have no shame, and certainly no scruples. No, the real concern is that it's actually looking like Americans have finally been dumbed down past the point where they're even able, much less willing, to do anything about it. Well, after all of that, we need to change gears just a bit and talk about a little bit of sanity, which, surprisingly, managed to find its way into the U.S. Senate on Thursday when Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky shut down an effort by the capo de tutti capo of anti-constitutionalist Chuckie Schumer of New York to try to rebuke President Trump over his decision, horror of horrors, to honor one of his campaign promises and actually withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. Finally, Schumer attempted to get consent on Thursday to bring up the House-passed resolution saying that, quote, we're in real trouble, unquote, said the Hill. And, well, with the likes of Schumer and the other far-left nutcases in both the Senate and the House, we are in real trouble, but not for the reasons those criminals suggest. Anyway, on Tuesday, you may remember, the House voted 354-60 to oppose the decision to end United States efforts in Syria, prompting Senator Paul to blast the Chucky doll, saying, quote, he should come to the floor and say that we're ready to declare war, we're ready to authorize force, and we're going to stick our troops in the middle of this messy, five-sided civil war where we would be ostensibly opposed to the Turkish government that's made an incursion. In other words, Senator Paul laid it right on the constitutional line. Hey, if you don't like what's going on here, you've always had the constitutional authority to actually declare war, so why the heck don't you go do it? Adding that the House-passed resolution would do, quote, nothing to fix the problem. And this follows up an appearance on CNN with Jake Tapper on Wednesday, where Dr. Paul said that pulling U.S. troops from northern Syria, quote, may be the best thing that's ever happened to the Kurds, adding it was the president's decision. It was the best thing not only for our troops, but it's also the best way to adhere to the Constitution, which he noted says you don't declare a war unless Congress votes on it. And who are we going to declare war against anyway? Our ally Turkey? The Free Syrian Army that used to be our ally? Or Syrian President Bashar al-Assad? After which he hearkened back to other major disasters and debacles in the region, like the loss of the Marines in Beirut, saying that given the disparity of forces in the area, quote, I think he, meaning the president, made the right decision. And I guess it's worth noting, folks, that a lot of people, including your host, have made the observation for quite some time that if the Congress is really so concerned about border incursions, maybe they'd better turn their eyes to the southern border between Texas and California with Mexico. These Congress cretins really do seem anxious to send our American boys off to die. Why not let them fight for something that actually matters? And hey, it's constitutional besides. So let's recap a funny follow-up here. Nutcase Nancy and Chuckie Schumer aren't the only warmongers who just can't stand the president actually keeping another campaign promise and trying to withdraw troops from Syria. The unstable rhino from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, is at it again, too.
I will do anything I can to help him, but I will also become President Trump's worst nightmare. I will not sit alone on the sidelines and watch a good ally, the Kurds, be slaughtered by Turkey and watch Iran move into Syria and become another nightmare for Israel. This is a defining moment for President Trump. He needs to up his game.
And if he actually does continue to stand up to the likes of Lindsey Graham, he is. And here's what the president himself had to say about it.
Lindsey Graham would like to stay in the Middle East for the next 1,000 years with thousands of soldiers and fighting other people's wars. I want to get out of the Middle East. I think Lindsey should focus right now on judiciary. He ought to find out about what happened with Comey, what happened with McCabe, Lisa, what happened with Peter Strzok, what happened with President Obama, what happened with Brennan. That's what Lindsey ought to focus on. That's what the people of South Carolina want him to focus on. The people of South Carolina don't want us to get into a war with Turkey a NATO member, or with Syria. Let them fight their own wars. They've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them fight their own wars.
And since we're on the subject, I guess this bit of sanity from Dr. Paul Sr., Ron Paul, former congressman from Texas, really fits here too. Dr. Ron Paul of the Ron Paul Institute, I saw it via LouRockwell.com, wrote earlier this week about how Washington, no surprise here, is wrong again. And in particular, he's referring to the Kurds join Assad to defend Syria stories. When President Trump, he begins tweeted last week that it's time for us to get out of these ridiculous endless wars, adding that the U.S. would thus be withdrawing from Syria, Washington, says Dr. Paul, went into a panic. Suddenly, Republicans, Democrats, the media, the so-called think tanks, and the big war industry all discovered and quickly became experts on the Kurds, who we were told were an ally, he puts it in quotes, being sent to their slaughter by an ignorant President Trump. But all of that, writes Paul, was just another bipartisan ploy to keep the forever war gravy train rolling through the Beltway. Interventionists, he continued, will do anything to prevent U.S. troops from ever being allowed to come home, and their favorite tactic is promoting mission creep. And as President Trump tweeted, we're told back in 2014 by then-President Obama that the U.S. military would go into Syria for just 30 days to save the Yazidi minority that they claimed was threatened. Then the mission creep went into, we must fight ISIS. So the U.S. military continued to illegally occupy and bomb Syria for 5 more years. And even though it was the Syrian army with its Russian and Iranian allies that did the bulk of the fighting against Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria, even though, I note, they did manage to get a hold of a whole bunch of U.S. weaponry. Thank you, Hitlery. Et al. Kind of makes you wonder what the quid pro quo was there, too. Well, don't expect the waste stream to talk about that, of course. Continues Dr. Paul, it was President Trump who took credit and then called for the troops to come home. But when the military comes home, the military-industrial congressional media complex loses its cash cow, so they need to invent a new rationale. Therefore, he says, the latest mission creep was that we had to stay in Syria, this time to save our allies, the Kurds, and all of a sudden our military presence in Syria was not about fighting terrorism, as if it ever was, but rather about putting U.S. troops between our NATO ally, Turkey, and our proxy fighting force, the Kurds. Says Dr. Paul, do they really want us to believe that it is pro-American for our troops to fight and die, refereeing a long-standing dispute between the Turks and the Kurds? It was, he says, a colossally dumb idea in the first place to train and arm the Kurds in Syria. But after spending billions backing what turned out to be Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria to overthrow the Assad government, Washington discovered to its shock that the Kurds were the only willing boots remaining on the ground. While their interest in fighting ISIS was pretty limited, they were happy to use Washington's muscle in pursuit of their own long-term goal of carving out a part of Syria, and eventually Turkey, for themselves. We can never leave, goes the story, because there will be a slaughter, Washington claimed, and the media, of course, faithfully repeats. But once again, the politicians, the waste stream media, and the so-called experts in the Beltway have been proven wrong. They never understand that sending U.S. troops into another country without the proper authority, he's talking about that Constitution thing, folks, as he often does, but Washington never pays any attention to, but sending troops into another country without proper authority is not a stabilizing factor, but instead a destabilizing factor. Says Dr. Paul, I've argued that were the U.S. to leave Syria, and indeed the rest of the Middle East, the countries of the region would manage to find a way to solve their own problems. Not like we can't make them worse, however. And now he says that the U.S. is pulling back from northern Syria. That is just what's happening. On Sunday, the Kurds and the Syrian government signed an agreement, brokered by the Russians, to put aside their differences and join together to defend against Turkey's incursion into Syrian territory. And now our so-called Kurdish allies are fighting alongside the army of President Assad of Syria, who we are still told by U.S. officials must go. Washington, concludes the former congressman, just doesn't understand that our intervention only makes matters worse. And yes, he says, the best way to help the Kurds and everyone else in the region is to just come home. And here, folks, your host has to add one final, and yeah, I'll admit it, disgusting observation. The place where U.S. military troops might truly be needed is on the California-Nevada border to defend ourselves from an incursion from the left coast by who knows how many foreign and other types of communists, insurgents, and evildoers. Once unthinkable, I'd say it's now pretty well undeniable. And for those military that do talk about trying to defend the Constitution of these United States, at least when it comes to the People's Republic of California, whether you realize yet that it's a CHICOM satellite or not, that case is now pretty easy to make. Next, we have to return to a question that we've asked before in a world increasingly and obviously utterly insane.
When we look at what's going on lately, can we still ascribe most of it to stupidity, or do we have to admit that a whole lot of it is just plain evil?
On the heels of that story from last week about the young girl in Kansas who was charged with a felony for the dreaded finger gun pointing, and reports from Red Flag, Florida, that children as young as 8 years old are finding themselves red flagged, no guns for you ever, and hey, this way you'll grow up not even worrying about the concept of private property, because you really are a slave, whether you know it yet or not.
We turn now to the opposite end of the spectrum, but still the same kind of incredibly stupid and utterly evil. An 84-year-old Korean War veteran who served as a police officer in Tidsbury, Massachusetts for 6 decades and has been employed more recently as a school crossing guard for the Tidsbury School has had his guns confiscated under the anti-constitutional abomination called red flag laws. His crime? He criticized a school resource officer because he was unhappy that the resource officer was taking coffee breaks while children were arriving at school in the morning, stating his belief that such integral personnel should remain on post at all times when the safety of school students was at risk. Are you ready for this? He expressed his concerns to a friend at a local restaurant a few weeks back, which was overheard by a waitress who made a police report. Thereafter, he lost his job and his guns. The veteran and former police officer, 84-year-old Stephen Nichols, stated that no paperwork or documentation was provided to him after the red flag gun theft. And the owner of the restaurant in which Nichols was speaking about his concerns has stated that the police treatment of the 84-year-old man was outrageous, and he believes one of his employees overreacted, gee, do you think, by making a police report. And, of course, no surprise, Tidsbury police have steadfastly refused to discuss any details of the case, said Big League Politics.
Well, let's not kid ourselves, folks. This is precisely what red flag gun confiscation is all about. Unless we have any doubt whatsoever where this is intended to go, we can turn to the People's Republic of Communist California, which added 15 new anti-constitutional firearms-related bills on Friday, including yet another expansion of the red flag theft. This time they're adding co-workers, employers, and educators to the list of other people who can already say, hey, Achtung, no guns for you. And yeah, folks, the obvious question is how long until Twitter, to Facebook, and Gulag, along with your Chinese-style socialist credit score, are added to the Stasi-style retinue? And here's what's, well, I won't say funny, ha-ha, but it's certainly twisted anyway, in California's newest assault on the Bill of Rights. As the Zero Hedge headline puts it, even the ACLU is now admitting these latest constitutional infringements are so broad that they pose a, quote, significant threat to civil liberties. And when the anti-constitutional liars unite to admit that something's over the top, you know the truth is that they've already stuck a fork in it. And can we turn from this topic without at least looking at a piece from the Pulse Daily News about how Democrats, no surprise here, now want to make joining the NRA illegal? It's no secret anymore that deep staters and socialists want to do away completely with the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Now, a new Rasmussen poll says that 1 in 3 likely Democrat voters favor declaring gun rights groups to be terrorist organizations. Funny how the same socialists are just fine with the likes of MS-13, Antifa, and ISIS, though, isn't it? But the insanity may finally have reached the point where it might finally have even pushed a CNN host over the top, if you can believe that. Just hours, says Paul Joseph Watson's coverage, after the gun-banning fake Hispanic Robert O'Rourke, who calls himself Beto because he hopes people might believe the rest of his lies too, promised to go door-to-door stealing people's rifles, like AR-15s, he appeared on CNN still pushing his anti-constitutional gun confiscation plan. And let me tell you up front, folks, this clip is just so precious, you have to listen carefully. And that includes the pauses, too, which speak volumes, and certainly more intelligence in the silence than in Beto. And in fairness, I think at first he's just plain stunned that a CNN host would actually demonstrate some intelligence and not lap up his Kool-Aid like a little puppy dog. So basically it begins, he was asked, when you complete the total infringement of the Second Amendment and decide to outright confiscate people's firearms, do you really think they'll turn them in?
I fully expect my fellow Americans to follow the law.
You expect mass shooters to follow the law?
Our fellow Americans will follow the law, yes.
Congressman, mass shooters don't fall by definition. The mass shooters in Parkland, in El Paso, I could go on for 10 minutes. They don't follow the law by definition. It doesn't make sense that people are going to hand over their assault weapons. If they're mass shooters, if they want to do harm to people, they're not going to follow the law. So then what's your plan?
Yeah. So I don't know that you make any law or stop making any law because you fear that some people will not follow the law in any part of American life.
All right. Well, on this point, CNN host Carol Costello is literally on a roll. But I do have to interject something important here, that the Irish faux Hispanic is obviously ignorant of, and the CNN host could probably be excused for never having heard about, and that's the concept of what law is, and more importantly, is not. And a law in violation of the Constitution, Beto, is not a real law, but is, quote, wholly void and ineffective for any purpose, and is as inoperative as if it had never been passed. And furthermore, says Amger, it's void, it imposes no duties, confers no right, creates no office, bestows no power or authority on anyone, affords no protection, and justifies no acts performed under it. And that includes killing American citizens who won't go along with your communist confiscation scheme.
Yeah. So I don't know that you make any law or stop making any law because you fear that some people will not follow the law.
And evidently, you don't let things like the Bill of Rights stop you from making law either.
In any part of American life.
If somebody doesn't voluntarily hand over their assault weapon, you're going to go to their house, and then what?
He won't say it, folks. I will. They're going to go to their house, and they're going to kill them, and then take their stuff. Just like every other gun-banning totalitarian regime in history.
If somebody doesn't voluntarily hand over their assault weapon, you're going to go to their house, and then what?
If we pass this law, then I expect our fellow Americans to follow the law. And this is not speculation. We've seen other countries do this,
yeah,
like Australia.
Law, I mean, seen a significant decrease in law. Law-abiding people follow the law, but our problem is with mass shooters who don't.
She's right, of course. And our bigger problem, as we'll probably find out, is with politicians who don't either, which is what the point of the Second Amendment was, come to think of it. Well, I'm going to close out the first segment for this evening with a bit of a reminder that may surprise some folks who really haven't spent that much time studying the Bible. But still, given all the attempts to foment a civil war, destroy the very basis upon which this nation was once built, i.e. the concept of God-given rights and a creator who wrote a book for us about what the law was supposed to be based upon, I think it's important to remember, especially during this season. And since this may come as a bit of a surprise, I encourage all of you to do what Scripture says. Study the truth for yourselves. See if what I'm suggesting is true. And it's not that hard to find. Although many of you probably are aware by now that no, Jesus Christ was not actually born during the winter solstice like all the other pagan sun gods supposedly were on December 25th. Because among other things, shepherds weren't actually out watching over their flocks by night during the dead of winter in the Holy Land. Instead, and you can confirm this by checking to see when John the Baptist was born, 6 months ahead of him, and find out that the Messiah was almost certainly born during the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkot, which is actually happening right now for a whole lot of very consistent reasons, including the fact that one way to translate sukkah, or temporary structure, into Old English is manger. And furthermore, the reason why it was a great time for a census, and why there wouldn't have been any room at the inn, is because all of the men of the land were required to come up during this feast to the place where they ended up all being. And as they say, the rest is history, even if so many of us have never been taught the truth. And isn't that at least consistent? This season, though, according to the Bible, really is very much a time for joy.
my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black, tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening, folks. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's continue our look at the insanity now passing for news with, where else, the People's Republic of California, and a story that suggests perhaps there's a lot more going on there than meets the eye. Via local station WJLA-TV, which said on Tuesday that a refinery fire had broken out at Rodeo, California, near San Francisco. And wasn't that near the place where they turned off all the power to a couple million people to prevent wildfires? But now they've got this. What an amazing coincidence. Oh, and later in the week, there were suggestions they may decide to do that blackout thing again. Eyewitnesses told KPIX that an explosion caused the area to shake, and residents in the area have been asked to shelter in place. What else? The blaze was later contained, although both directions of Interstate 80 were closed for most of the day. But at least so far, it's unknown exactly what caused the incident. And you know what, folks? I'm almost suspicious that if they did know, they wouldn't tell you the truth anyway. After that, for reasons that I won't try to explain, but might or might not become obvious, let's go here to Socialist France and a piece by Alain Deschaye at the Gatestone Institute, also via Zero Hedge, about the terror attacks in France called A Culture of Denial. Imagine that. On October 3rd of this year, a knife-wielding Muslim employee of the Paris Police Department Intelligence Directorate stabbed to death four other employees at police headquarters in the center of Paris before a trainee officer shot and killed him. Guess he brought a knife to a gunfight. And while it wasn't the deadliest terror attack in France by far, says the piece, the fatal stabbings that took place at the Paris Police HQ were perhaps the most worrisome. Because of its author, a French public servant, and I do have to put the word sick after that for sure, folks, employed by police, its highly sensitive target, and not least, the catastrophic handling of the aftermath of the attack, reveal the failure of French institutions. And of course, the point here is, doesn't seem to be limited to socialist France anymore. As was the case for all the recent terror attacks, French media and authorities first tried to downplay what happened.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for. Move along. Move along.
The attacker was initially described via potentially mitigating factors. Oh, you know, he had a rough childhood. Well, in this case, the handicap. He was partially deaf and mute. It took 24 hours before it was eventually revealed that he was, in fact, say it with me, folks, an Islamic militant who had carefully planned out the attack. And, says the piece, the idea that a radicalized militant had been able to remain undetected, or, well, perhaps better put, folks, ignored in a critical security institution for years sent shockwaves throughout the country. But, says the author, for the record, his so-called very normal behavior included cutting down to a bare minimum any communication with women. For months, he'd avoided talking with any of them at all but his wife, attending a notoriously radical mosque, hey, nothing unusual there, and having a phone full of Islamist contacts. His colleagues reported that already in January of 2015, he had cheered the murderous Islamist terror attack on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in front of other police employees. Nah, nothing surprising there either. And in many countries, a mistake of this scale would be enough for a government minister to resign. But not in France, and hey folks, not in California, it would seem, either. But I'm not, of course, suggesting there could be any parallels here, right? The whole picture of the attack, which is still not clear, demonstrates an incredible failure of internal control inside the French police. And even the parliament in France is now asking how this murderer managed to fly so far under the radar when everything in his behavior clearly signaled he was a radical Islamic. And there's a lot more here, but I suspect you get the picture. This latest attack, says the piece, demonstrates just how inadequately prepared France is to tackle the problem. And, not for the first time, folks, your host will suggest it's not about being inadequately prepared. More to the point, it's about being set up. This is nothing but socialism and its associated political correctness gone insane. The story continues, saying that even beyond the political sphere, there's a culture of denial. Gee, do you think? Of the Islamist threat in the French media. journalists, academics, and politicians, hey, do they have a French version of Hollywood? With few exceptions, have consistently played down not only the risk of terrorist attacks, but also the threat of growing Salafist radicalization throughout the country. As a growing number of Muslims, it says, who don't yet advocate violence, do desire to live under Sharia law, which certainly does, separate from the rest of French society. And according to a study from the Montaigne Institute, 29% of Muslims in France, which is a far bigger number than it ever used to be, now believe that Sharia law is more important than French law, meaning that about a third of French Muslims live according to values that are fundamentally incompatible with either French or even Western standards. And of course, the problem is that politicians in France, the European country most targeted by Islamics, are paralyzed by the fear of being accused by the mainstream media of discrimination. Or Islamophobia. Can you say that in French? I'll butcher this next line, but let's try it anyway. These are typical examples, says the author, of what some call la démission des élites, the abdication of the elites, referring to a situation of which they're perfectly well aware, but afraid to mention, because, of course, of the dominant ideology of political correctness. But in the meantime, French police officers are increasingly unmotivated and demoralized, and since the start of the year, more than 50 of them have committed suicide. In part, says the story, because they face increasingly difficult working conditions, gee, do you think? In particular, rioters in the suburbs of cities like Paris, Marseille, or Lyon, suburbs that progressively, and I'm going to say pun not intended, but it's there, are escaping the control of French authorities. Attack after attack, the article concludes, the ritual's the same. There are flowers, tributes, and words for the victims. Political leaders reaffirm their resolve to protect the people. And, of course, in the process, take away more of their rights and bring in more of the invaders. But back to the story. After a few days, says the author, the news cycle ends and things go back to normal. Until the next terrorist attack. There's a lesson here, and lest you doubt that it's playing out before our very eyes on the left coast, take a listen to this story. From Monica Showalter at TheAmericanThinker.com, California's outright communist governor, Gavin Newsom, signs yet another so-called law, this time to put illegals on state boards. Evidently sucking at the public teat via free education, free health care, free housing, and of course sanctuary city status isn't enough. He wants to make sure they can rule over those that they're invading in the process. Yeah, talk about disenfranchisement, begins the author. Now it looks like locals, those few that remain, may find themselves being lorded over directly by foreign nationals with absolutely zero loyalty to the United States to make policy. Hey, kind of like what's already happened in the California State House and Governor's Mansion. The abomination was called SB 225, and it expands eligibility for state appointments to anybody who just happens to be in California by hook or by crook over the age of 18. And in his signing message, the socialist governor said applicants deserve to be considered on their merits, well, or lack thereof, rather than any other items he could think of. Quote, building a more representative government requires an assessment of barriers that prevent talented and qualified Californians from consideration for public service. Sick, he said. California doesn't succeed in spite of our diversity. Our state succeeds because of it. And yeah, don't let the burning door hit you on the you-know-what on the way out, folks. And get this. The idea is so bad that it was actually vetoed in 2018 by the previous communist governor of the state, Governor Moonbeam Jerry Brown, who also vetoed twice the same ultra-leftist totalitarian red flag gun confiscations that Newsom signed the other day, too, writes Showalter. The bill's sponsor, Senator Maria Elena Durazo, is a far-left activist who accompanied Newsom on his first trip as governor to El Salvador on a junket to find out how to make illegals in California even happier. And gee, folks, how better to manage to entice more of them to come in, if you think about it. And it's not just illegals from the South that some people in California with half a brain are concerned about. The Chinese government, too, suggests the author, just might want to take advantage of what they've already pretty well bought by sending someone over to defend their interests and having a loyalty not to the United States, but to them. Do you think? Mexico, of course, if they had the same kind of money China does, could do the same thing, probably just not quite as effectively. About the only people who won't be represented in California might end up being constitution-toting actual Americans. Because let's not forget, those people are the only ones you can openly discriminate against. And ask the author, do you think it could create some interesting foreign policy problems? Imagine the government of El Salvador or Honduras, who just might find it useful to have some of their nationals, too, on an appropriate California board next time there's a clash of interest between California and Washington on, well, any of a number of fronts. You can bet a lot of places are already doing the calculations. And here, folks, your host has to conclude the author might be being a bit too kind. I think the fix was already in, and the boards were already paid for before this bill was passed and signed. And boards run the gamut, from the minor bodies dedicated to things like beautifying parks or putting more needles and feces around, to the very powerful like the California Coastal Commission. And from the sound of that one alone, you know the Chi-Coms will want to run it. And there are court boards, too. Imagine a group of illegals running the California courts. I know, that's not hard at all now, is it? And there's nothing in the law that just passed saying an entire board can't be made up entirely of illegals. And if you stop to think about it, folks, if illegals can actually run the boards that run the state, who needs the vote anyway? It's obviously been a dead letter for real Californians for quite a while now. But the bottom line here is it really does kind of lend new meaning to the old phrase, the lunatics running the asylum. Meanwhile, I'm kind of wondering how long it'll be till Governor Newsom signs a bill saying that the only people in California who are still allowed to possess a gun have to be members of MS-13, ISIS, or La Raza. All right, well, with all of that buildup, you know by now where we're headed, right? Sure, all of the 12 far-left candidates who want to be the next U.S. dictator, because they know how to run your life better than you ever could. And let's step back, far back, and get some perspective from the leftists on the other side of the pond. The Daily Mail headline says the following. Elizabeth Warren, yeah, Pocahontas herself, cements her status as the Democrat frontrunner by being the focus of rivals' attacks in the latest 2020 debate. But it's Bolshevik Bernie who gets AOC, as if that mattered, and her jihad squad's coveted endorsement. Meanwhile, though, all 12 candidates managed to agree on at least one thing, besides their hatred for the Bill of Rights and their love of communism, and that is that they want to impeach the guy they don't really want to run against anyway, Donald Trump. Yes, it says a dozen socialists, but they don't call them that, were in Westerville, Ohio for the fourth primary debate on Tuesday night. Senator Bolshevik Bernie Sanders took to the stage just a few weeks after his heart attack, reassuring the crowd about his health, saying, "I'm healthy, I'm feeling great." And from there on out, the lies just kept on a-coming. Creepy, decrepit old Joe Biden defended his family's name, get that, during the debate, despite scrutiny, oh, you can bet it was really tough, folks, over the Ukraine scandal and his criminal son's international business dealings, saying, "My son did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. Well, that I remember, anyway." That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Oh, and here's another one of the real whoppers in their subheadline review. Biden's son, Hunter, was interviewed by ABC News Tuesday morning, where it says, "No topic was off limits." Oh, skipping down through the article itself, there's at least one interesting bit of debate commentary that's worth noting here. Biden went after Warren directly, it says later on in the debate, when he claimed his political rivals couldn't measure up to his accomplishments. Listen to this, quote, "I'm the only one on the stage who's gotten anything really big done," unquote. "And I've got millions and millions of ill-gotten gains to prove it." Pocahontas has recently emerged as the frontrunner, surpassing Biden in several polls this month, but she does face controversy, it says, over claims she was forced from a teaching position once upon a time because she was pregnant, which critics point out she's lied about over and over again and even contradicted herself in the past. But wait a minute, isn't she an Indian too? All right, well, truth be told, folks, I literally didn't see anything in the coverage of this entire debate that wouldn't have made an honest liberal Democrat from, say, 2 decades ago blush with embarrassment over how far out in literal left field and utter insanity that Bolshevik Party has gone. When Ronald Reagan said he doesn't leave the Democratic Party, it left him. He hadn't seen nothing yet. This, though, is a bit eye-opening and funny. It's not going to get much mainstream coverage either. Comes from Information Liberation and Chris Menahan about a plant that the criminally negligent network, no surprise here, failed to disclose at the maximally politically correct LGBT town hall last week. the fact that the questioner who teed one up for Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren for her zinger of the night, as they call it, which really wasn't as clever as the joke writers thought it was anyway, and doesn't bear repeating, in fact, quote, donated the federal maximum to her 2018 Massachusetts Senate campaign, according to the Washington Free Beacon. The story says CNN sycophant Chris Cuomo introduced one Morgan Cox to the town hall as the chair of the Human Rights Campaign Board of Directors, unquote. But it could have just as easily identified Cox as the author as donor Elizabeth Warren, concluding with his own much funnier zinger that CNN's town halls are as fake as ABC's war footage. And if you missed that one, folks, yeah, ABC got caught lying through their teeth again when they aired footage of a Kentucky gun range and actually had the gall to try to pass it off as footage of, quote, Turkey's military bombing Kurd civilians after being abandoned by President Trump. And I kid you not. Turns out, though, they were stupid enough to use footage of the famous Knob Creek gun range machine gun shoot in Bullock County, Kentucky, where aficionados of high-end weapons literally spend a lot of money to light up the night. Maybe they thought they wouldn't get caught because nobody who knows anything about guns would ever pay attention to that network, but those who've been to Knob Creek could hardly miss the extravaganza, not to mention the chutzpah. And yes, once they got caught and had their noses rubbed in it, they did take down the video and try to cover their tracks, but, notes Menahan, they never did admit the embarrassing source, saying only that the video that appeared to be from the Syrian border, yeah, if you're an idiot, was taken down after, quote, questions were raised about its accuracy. ABC News regrets the error, unquote. And what a bunch of feted liars, folks. It was no error. It was an outright in-your-face whopper. They regret that they got caught. And somehow this fits, especially when we're talking about Democrat leftists who claim to be feminists, all the while they'd prefer to see women groped in airports and raped rather than being allowed to defend themselves with a firearm. And while it's arguably a sick joke, much like Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, it evidently wasn't supposed to have been, although it has the potential to be no less deadly than any of those. Says Paul Joseph Watson at Summit News, Forbes, the magazine, faced ridicule and condemnation after that media outlet encouraged women to travel alone in Pakistan, including the areas where the Taliban is active. Quote, Pakistan. It's not exactly on every solo female traveler's bucket list, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be, said the article, which serves as promotional material for vlogger Eva Zubek, who made a video asserting that Pakistan, quote, could be the world's number one tourism destination. And the article even notes how Beck headed straight into Taliban territory during the trip, which is clearly, notes Watson, a fantastic idea for any female traveling alone, and of course, like any good leftist, utterly disarmed. Commented one astute observer with a background that seems to indicate she knows what she's talking about, this would be a good idea only if it were the last item on her bucket list, said Yasmin Mohammed. And added another, is the bucket for her head to be carried around in? Still another said, yeah, you can get the same expansive dirt-filled vistas in northern Nevada. And as a plus, you're more likely to return home with your head still attached to your neck where it belongs. Watson goes on to note that, as he's previously documented, there are innumerable examples of women traveling alone or as a couple to highly dangerous locations, perhaps because they've been drinking too much liberal Kool-Aid and ending up being raped and murdered. And notably, those victims probably got disabused of their naive belief that the world is a progressive utopia and all cultures are equal, just before it was too late to do them or anybody else any good. Finally, we turn to what might be a bit of good news from across the pond, where it looks like the Trump of the UK, Boris Johnson, may have actually secured what's being called an amazingly good Brexit deal, and could even get it passed. No doubt about it, there are still some hurdles to be crossed, and the weekend will probably give us a pretty good indication of how that's going to play out. But suffice it to say for now, there's no doubt a whole lot of behind-the-scenes British insider politics arm-twisting going on. A lot seems to hinge on a small party in Northern Ireland calling itself the Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, that seems to be enamored of playing the role of the spoiler. But here's what we know as of the time I did this recording. The battle for Brexit has begun, says one summary, and the stakes are high. because for Boris's plan to succeed, he needs both Parliament and the EU ministers to buy into the notion that it's either this deal or the dreaded no deal. But as he tries to sell the deal, Johnson's discovering that more MPs, or members of Parliament, share his concerns that Brexit might never get done, and it's time to put all of that to rest for good, even though many in Parliament remain skeptical, meaning that it looks now that any way you slice it, this one will be close. And once again, it's the DUP that will leave another Tory Prime Minister, says Zero Hedge's summary, hung out to dry by opting to vote against the deal. Even though others have suggested that the DUP and its leader, Arlene Foster, had sent some signals they would reluctantly back what is called his imperfect plan if he could sell it to Brussels, which actually seems to have happened, because EU ministers voted to unanimously back the deal yesterday after Jean-Claude Juncker had given it his, well, perhaps reluctant blessing. But in any case, Johnson is now turning his attention to an even greater obstacle, Parliament. Where his predecessor, Theresa May, at least pretended to try, and of course failed, to pass her version of a withdrawal agreement, which does seem to be quite a bit different than the one that Boris has come up with, now that she's gone and almost forgotten. And here's where things get interesting, and yeah, a bit murky too. Bloomberg suggests that if Johnson loses in Parliament, a political crisis might be unleashed, as the Prime Minister has repeatedly refused to say he'd go along with asking for another delay on October 31st. But given that the Benn Act was passed by Parliament last month over Johnson's objections, any attempt to leave without a deal, the no-deal Brexit, would face a legal challenge. Because the law requires Boris to ask for an extension if Parliament hasn't voted for a withdrawal deal by the end of the day on October 19th. Well, there's that historic Saturday deadline. And they note here that Parliament hasn't sat on a weekend since the early 1980s at the outset of the Falklands War. So here we turn next to Ms. Shedlock, who writes about what he calls an amazingly good Brexit deal, but that constitutional challenge looms. Yes, it begins, a deal has been reached, and a constitutional challenge already seems to be underway, because the European Commission President and the EU have reached that deal, but EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker also opposes an extension, which isn't his call, Mish notes, but it's what he expected. And he included a link in the story to a video of Juncker saying he's happy for a deal, but sad to see the UK go. Member of Parliament Andrea Jenkins writes that Boris's deal sounds better than the WA because it ends free movement, ends ECJ supremacy over UK law, ditches the backstop, and they can do free trade agreements. I want to read the details, she says, before making up my mind, but well done, Boris, for getting this far and doing what others have said was impossible. Whereupon Mish quotes at length a whole bunch of inside Britain sources. Does he or does he not have the votes? Will he be able to make it in time? Some say yes, some say no. Even if the DUP doesn't go along, he may still have enough. Another referendum, too, which is one of the options if the Brexit doesn't happen, is, says Mish, unlikely. And who knows how that would work out. And in any event, even if the deal does pass, legal challenges, as you might expect, still loom. But, says Ms. Shedlock, there is one other final irony that may come up. The possibility is that if the legal challenge wins, a hard Brexit might happen anyway, one which Boris Johnson could then blame on the naysayers, Labour, the Liberal Democrats, and the so-called Remainers. And he'd be right, of course. Says Ms., Boris Johnson needs to swing about 30 votes for his Brexit deal to pass, and that is his expectation, he adds, even though some insist it won't be able to pass without DUP, even though the Telegraph number crunch says that's not necessarily the case. And much hinges on whether or not Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn will try to expel any Labour member of Parliament who ends up crossing over and voting for the deal. But analysts say if Corbyn backs off from that threat, Bojo's plan could even pass with a huge margin. In any case, Mish concludes by suggesting that he thinks Bojo's Brexit will pass, even if just barely. And then he quotes Daniel Hannan, who calls it an amazingly good deal, saying, "The EU agreement that they have here delivers the supremacy of British law, an independent UK trade policy, no annual tribute to Brussels, good control locally of farming and fishing, and good relations still with our EU neighbors." And since Hannan, says Mish, is a free market advocate, if he likes the deal, so do I. So he concludes, given that he had one hand tied behind his back, Boris Johnson did amazingly well. And I guess from here on out, We'll see.